This is On Science, a weekly podcast from NPR's Science Desk. I'm Andrew Prince, a web producer here. This week, we've got three stories for you. We'll turn to archaeology and humans' not-too-distant past to see if live fast, die young is really the best way to go. Evolutionarily, of course. And astronomers have some new research to share about a nearby black hole. But we're going to start this week with dialects. Studies have shown that we unconsciously make judgments about people based on their regional accents. Now scientists have evidence that our brains have a hardwired bias against accents that don't sound like our own. And NPR's John Hamilton has the report from the Society of Neuroscience meeting in San Diego.
Here's a short message read by three different people from three different parts of the English-speaking world. It's made up of samples from the Speech Accent Archive at George Mason University.
Please call Stella. Ask her to bring these things with her from the store.
6 spoons of fresh snow peas, 5 thick slabs of blue cheese, and maybe a snack for her brother Bob.
She can scoop these things into 3 red bags, and we'll go meet her on Wednesday at the train station.
Patricia Bestelmeyer says if you're Scottish, you like the last speaker best, or at least your brain did. Bestelmeyer should know. She's part of a team at the University of Glasgow that used a functional MRI scanner to study the brains of 20 native Scots.
We asked Scottish participants in the scanner to listen to native English accents such as Scottish, American and Southern English, and then had a look at the neural correlates of what they heard.
To keep things simple, the volunteers heard only female voices reading lists of numbers. Earlier research had found that people process words spoken in their own accent more quickly and with less effort. So Bestelmeyer figured the brain scans would show that the part of the brain processing accents wouldn't be working as hard.
You would normally expect a decrease in brain activity, but they showed a huge increase to their own accent.
When the Scottish volunteers listened repeatedly to an American or Southern English accent, their brain activity gradually diminished. But that didn't happen when they listened repeatedly to someone speaking in their own accent. Bestelmeyer says that suggests people are paying more attention to someone from their own group. She says it makes evolutionary sense that our brains are wired to detect accents.
Accents convey important information about the speaker's social background, for example, social status.
And an accent is a quick way to tell whether someone is part of our own group or an outsider. Bestelmeyer's team still doesn't know precisely how the human brain does all this. But believe it or not, songbirds also have regional accents, and a scientist who studies these accents thinks research on bird brains may help explain what's going on in the human brain. John Prather from the University of Wyoming says that, like people, songbirds learn to vocalize early in life and acquire something like a regional accent.
We studied a region of the bird brain that is involved in not only how they sing their songs, but how they perceive differences in their songs. And we found that individual neurons were able to recognize what's called categorical differences between features of song.
In other words, specific brain cells that can recognize a particular accent. So Prather and his team compared songbirds from Pennsylvania with songbirds from New York. And they found specific brain cells in the Pennsylvania birds that responded to songs sung in their own accent.
When the neuron was responding to one category, it would respond very strongly and with very precise timing.
But Prather says when a Pennsylvania bird heard a New York accent, that same brain cell would stop firing.
The neuron would effectively shut down. It would not respond at all.
So as with the people in New York and Pennsylvania, they can recognize each other's speech differences.
Right, right. Yeah, we actually think that's the reason that the Eagles and Giants fans don't get along.
Or at least why their brains start out with a bias. John Hamilton, NPR News, San Diego.
Astronomers have discovered what could be the birth of a nearby black hole. The discovery could help scientists understand how black holes form and evolve over time. NPR's Richard Harris says the story started in a backyard in Western Maryland.
On the evening of April 15, 1979, while countless Americans were rushing to finish their tax returns, Gus Johnson was on a cosmic pursuit in his backyard, touring one little corner of the heavens.
And I decided to share the tour using my 8-inch telescope and a pastor of my church.
The two men gazed up at a galaxy called M100 in the constellation Coma Berenices.
For some reason, I don't know why, this little star in M100 caught my attention.
On a hunch, he pulled up a detailed chart of all the stars in this part of the sky.
And it wasn't on it.
He had discovered an uncharted star. In fact, a star only visible because it was in the throes of a violent explosion, a supernova. Professional astronomers rolled out their giant telescopes and confirmed the discovery, now known as Supernova 1979C. Astronomers say the star that exploded was just 50 million light-years away and about 20 times the mass of our sun. And Abraham Loeb at the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics says when a star that size explodes, it can end up in one of two forms.
Either it makes a neutron star, which is the densest form of matter that we know about. It has the density similar to that of an atomic nucleus and a size comparable to that of a big city, or it ends up in a black hole, which is an object to which you can get in but can never get out of.
So fast forward to today. To figure out what befell the 1979 supernova, Loeb and his colleagues turned NASA's Chandra X-ray Observatory to that corner of the sky, and they now conclude that the supernova most likely ended up as a black hole.
If our interpretation is correct, and indeed supernova 1979C ended up as a black hole, then of course it's the first time that we're seeing a black hole being born in a normal supernova.
Loeb is quick to add that they see black holes being born all the time in abnormal supernovas, that is, vastly larger cosmic explosions from billions of light years away. Now, it's still possible the supernova did end up as a neutron star. Alex Filipenko from UC Berkeley says in that event, X-rays they witness could be coming from a huge cloud of glowing gas called a pulsar wind nebula, like the picturesque Crab Nebula.
So I'm pretty excited about this discovery, regardless of whether it turns out to be a young black hole or a pulsar wind nebula.
NASA announced the discovery at a news conference Monday. Richard Harris, NPR News.
It's safe to say that humans are the smartest creatures on Earth. After all, what other species is going to argue with you? But scientists do puzzle over how we got so smart. One way to figure that out is to look at the closest relative we ever had, the Neanderthal, that lumbering cousin of humans that died out about 30,000 years ago. As NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, scientists have some new insights into what set humans and Neanderthals apart.
Neanderthals lived in Europe alongside humans, and DNA evidence suggests they even mated with us. Despite our alleged intimacy, we think of them as dull, brutish, and poor conversationalists. And they went extinct, another sign of inferiority. Yet their brains were as big as ours, their tools just as good. So what did we Homo sapiens have that made us so clever? Tanya Smith, an anthropologist at Harvard University, explains one idea about how early humans got smarter.
Some of the earliest fossil Homo sapiens that we've looked at show a really long period of growth and development. They did not, live fast and die young. They seem to have lived slow and die old.
And Neanderthals did live fast and die young.
Yes, they did. Several of the ones that we studied seem to have matured several years faster than you would have predicted.
Now, maturing quickly does have advantages in a world with many saber-toothed cats and no doctors or pharmacies. If you live fast, you can reproduce sooner, and you pass on your genes ASAP. But some scientists believe modern humans developed a better way. Here's Jean-Jacques Hublin from the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Germany.
We take a long time to grow up and become adults. And this has a lot of implications in terms of social organization, time for education, maturation of the brain, even psychology somehow.
Like the slow food movement, slow growth gave complex brains more time to cook, so to speak, and then to learn all those things a fancy brain could learn. That's the idea, anyway. And now, in two research papers just published, Hublin and Smith have laid out some new evidence that confirms what scientists have suspected. Hublin, a paleoanthropologist, used a medical imaging machine to compare the skulls of Neanderthal and human infants. Both grew big brains fast, but the shape of the Neanderthal brain was more primitive. The human shape was different from anything that came before. Hublin says he thinks that took longer and also resulted in different wiring.
to put it very simply, I would say Neanderthals did not see the world as we see it.
And Smith's research backs that up with evidence from what lies underneath the brain, the teeth.
Teeth have these tiny recorders locked inside them. Like rings and trees, teeth have lines which reflect every single day of their formation, from before birth until the end of childhood.
Using a high-powered X-ray, Smith counted those lines in the teeth of Neanderthals and early humans and found that Neanderthal kids matured way faster than early humans did.
By age 8, they've got an extra couple of teeth already out in the mouth. You know, they're much closer to being adults than we would be at age 8.
Smith published her work in the latest issue of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, Hublin, in the journal Current Biology. They say slow growth may not seem like such a big difference between two species that were apparently close enough to mate, but Hublin says it doesn't take much in a social species to create a survival advantage.
You know, I used to make this joke that we never know what kind of relationship a Neanderthal had with his brother-in-law. And maybe this is what makes a big difference between a Neanderthal and us.
Consider that when the relatives visit this Thanksgiving. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
That's this week's On Science podcast. Listen next week for more science coverage from NPR. And as always, you can find these stories and more on our website, npr.org/science. I'm Andrew Prince.